This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. The election this month appeared to confirm what analysts have been saying. America is a nation divided. In one camp, people are who espouse conservative values, prefer small government, and live away from cities. In the other, urbanites who are more secular and have greater expectations from government. That's the stereotype. But is it the reality? Some skeptics say no. They say Americans still have a lot in common, and that this country is not nearly as divided as you might think. This hour, we'll look at what Americans agree on, and how those agreements provide us with national identity, a sense of what makes an American. We welcome you to join the conversation. What do you feel are the values we all share? Are there things you have in common with neighbors and coworkers who vote differently than you do? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. To start us off, we turn to Tom Smith, director of the General Social Survey at the University of Chicago, who's been studying American opinions on a number of issues. He joins us from studios at the University of Chicago. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, I mean... What about this idea that we're, this nation divided? Does your data show that there really are two Americas?
You know, the stories about two Americas, about polarization, sounds like there's no middle ground. And that's where they have the story wrong. Americans are of a lot of different opinions, have a lot of different values. But on most issues, the majority of Americans are towards the center, not towards the extreme. There are not two camps at opposite ends with nobody in the middle. Take, for example, abortion, which is often mentioned as one of the most divisive issues. We've been tracking abortion attitudes for 30 years. There's a way of analyzing those attitudes that you can put people into three groups. You have about 10% of the group, 10% of Americans, that are absolutely pro-life. They believe that the fetus should be preserved despite, in any circumstances, the needs and wishes of the woman carrying the fetus. Then you have about 30% of people who are absolutely pro-choice. They believe it's entirely up to the woman and there's no other consideration. But that means that 60% of Americans are in the middle. They believe abortion should be allowed under some conditions, for some reasons. They believe it should be allowed typically early in a pregnancy, but not late in the pregnancy. They believe it should be allowed, for example, for teenage women, when there's been some kind of a parental or guardian taking part in the decision. But what they don't belong to are the 40% of Americans that tend to be absolutist on this issue. The majority of Americans believe there's a blending of the needs and the rights of both the fetus and the woman, and they occupy the middle ground.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, but I think that even if it's not Americans viewing themselves, but if you go abroad, certainly the international view of America is that we're very tied up over this abortion issue. So you're saying we're politically tied up, but not socially tied up, because socially we're more in agreement.
That's right. If you looked at the organized groups, of course, they take a pretty absolute pro-life or pro-choice position and argue very strenuously for the righteousness of their respective positions. But when you look at where the mass opinion are, where Americans are, only a minority of them are in either of those ideological camps. The majority of them say, well, yes, I can see in some conditions it should be allowed, in others it shouldn't. And therefore, they have a conditional, not a polarized or an absolute position.
So, but that makes me think there was a phrase that I guess maybe came into disrepute, or not, depending on your philosophy, about the silent majority, where, these are the people that they're mostly like-minded on the issue, but you don't seem to hear from them. What about that?
Well, of course, the silent majority was a term essentially coined by the Republicans back in the 1960s to represent a majority of Americans who supposedly shared Republican values but hadn't been voting or hadn't been mobilized, and the idea that if they were, they would take and create a Republican majority. Here I am talking about a somewhat silent majority, but of a different nature. It is simply the average citizen who tends on most issues, on abortion, on civil liberties, on national defense, not to take extreme positions, to be in the middle. And since they're not well represented by the organized camps, the interest groups that tend to take more extreme positions, their position is more silent, which is one of the reasons why we get the position or get the image that we are more sharply divided. There's a difference between being divided and being sharply divided. For example, if you look at the vote by states, by one definition, it was a close election, and you can say, well, Americans were divided in their choice for president. If you look at the state-by-state vote, there was really only one state that a candidate was backed by a 70% to a 30% edge. In the vast majority of the states, you only have a candidate, you know, narrowly winning out, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, for example. Now, if you had a polarized nation, what you would have is the blue states would all be 80% for Kerry, the red states would all be 80 or 90% for Bush, and there'd be no middle ground. But when we look at the distribution by states, we see that it's a hard-fought, it's a contested election, but it's not a polarized election because most states are just narrowly, you know, tipping one way or the other. That's not a polarized nation.
Well, they're not geographically polarized, but they could be philosophically polarized and just living in peace with their neighbors.
True. You could look at it, you know, in terms of are we sharply divided by age group, by occupational class, and so on. And sure, you could look at it across a wide range of things. But the one, of course, I picked states because that's the one that's usually seen as a proof of this. You know, you show the map of the nation, and you have this big central chunk, which is red, and then the bi-coastal blue. And it's saying, see, you know, how sharply we are divided. But when you look at it state by state, the point is that most states are really shades of purple rather than being blue or red.
Let's take your calls. Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Chris in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wonder if in order to find more common ground, if we asked a question more open-endedly, such as, what is your definition of pro-life? You know, what, instead of saying, do you approve of abortion or not?
You're saying that the divisions appear more in the way the questions are asked than in the way the answers are given.
That's correct.
All right. Well, what about that, Tom Smith?
Sure. Open-ended questions are extremely valuable because they help you get the nuance of the position. If you're going to ask just a single question, then there's no way you can understand any issue because you can't get any variation. You can't take and get conditional, yes, I'm for abortion, but not for these reasons, or yes, I'm pro-life, but I can see the reason for letting women have a choice, even though I'm not in favor of that position. So either open-ended questions or multiple questions are really essential to truly understand the complexity of people's views.
Chris, thanks very much for your call. What about other, you know, issues that we feel are divisive, like Iraq, for example? Very strong feelings for and against the war in this country. Is there common ground on that, according to your data?
Well, even there, I think, you know, even if we looked at the candidates, where, of course, there was a difference of opinion on this, but you know, the Democrats did not go and nominate their anti-war candidate. They nominated someone who had a more moderate position on Iraq than Dean did, for example. So even there, it's, one of the issues they were arguing about is who would take and train Iraqis quicker to take over from Americans. Well, it wasn't like, let's get out of Iraq today versus we're going to stay here and put more and more troops in. Those would have been, of course, dramatically different positions. And the candidates and the American people were more towards the middle on this issue. Not that they aren't some people who have very strong feelings and are at the extremes, but again, you have to differentiate between where some very motivated people are and where most people are on this issue. Or take another very divisive issue that's been brought forward, gay marriage. And this is one that comes closest, quite frankly, to fitting the definition of a highly polarized issue. If you ask people about You know, should there definitely be gay marriage? Definitely shouldn't be. You can get quite some difference of opinion, and people are very firm in those opinions. But if you ask the question with the middle option of civil union, you find that that attracts more support, usually 35-40% of Americans being attracted to the civil union option than either the no form of marriage or union option or only full complete marriage. So even on that issue, which as I say, comes as close as any to being a polarizing issue, there's a substantial number of people, although not a majority in this case, who hold a middle position.
So it's almost as if people are searching for a middle ground.
Well, that's the thing about elections. You know, elections are wonderful. They allow us to democratically choose our leaders. But elections are contests. And the height of disagreement, the height of opposition of, you know, my candidate is right, your candidate is wrong, will happen, of course, at the peak of the election. During the rest of the year, there's much more necessity and much more, I would also say, experiences of collaboration. You have to form coalitions, usually, in both houses of Congress to get pieces of legislation passed. You have to drum up broader support than just you can win a majority, win an election with a simple majority or even actually a plurality of the votes or of the electoral college votes, of course.
Right.
But when you need to actually move legislation through, you need more of a consensus. So during those phases of the political cycle, there's greater emphasis on bringing sides together, finding middle ground, and hopefully there will be some movement towards this in the next year, which is the usual experience that one finds.
Let's take another call now. Amy in St. Louis, Missouri, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Your guest keeps speaking about states being purple, that there are no clear majorities. I do wish to point out, and I know he must be aware of this, that urban areas tend to be much, much bluer, and once you get out of the urban areas, it gets redder and redder. And this is also a continuum of aware of issues versus less aware, more educated versus less educated, tolerant of diversity versus less tolerant. And it is real.
Interesting point, Tom W. Smith.
Yes, your caller is entirely right. There's an urban-rural division, and suburbs are in between the two. But again, it's not like all cities are 90% Democratic and all rural areas are 90% Republican. There is, as your caller also said, a continuum. Cities tend to be more Democratic, and then suburbs are more Republican. Small towns and rural areas also tend to be more Republican. But many small towns and rural areas voted Democratic, and a few cities voted Republican, and many of them by not these polarizing majorities, but by small margins one way or the other.
But and Amy, thank you very much for the call.
Oh, thank you.
But it does, I mean, let me just ask you this, since we only have about a minute left. Have you seen any changes? Are things more polarized now than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago?
There was a study done using our general social survey looking at 30 years of attitudes, looking at several dozen different issues, abortion and capital punishment, and many topical issues. And on average, at least through 2002, in which this research was done, the degree of polarization in the 90s and 2000s was no greater on average than it was in the 70s.
All right. Tom W. Smith, thank you very much for joining us. Tom Smith is director of the General Social Survey at the University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Center. He joined us from studios at the University of Chicago. We're talking about what Americans have in common, those of us in red states and blue states, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. We're talking about American identity and about what Americans have in common politically and culturally. You're invited to join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Finding common ground among Americans is more than just a political exercise. Regardless of their diversity, Americans have a shared history and culture. Joining us now to discuss this is Michael Ledeen, author of the book Tocqueville on American Character and a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He joins us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday to you. So I don't know if you heard part of our discussion with Tom W. Smith, but he argues that Americans have a lot more in common than a quick perusal of the electoral map would suggest. Do you agree with that?
Well, sure. And remember that elections are competitions, and competitions always emphasize division. People root for different sides. But that doesn't mean that once the game is over, we don't have a lot in common.
I see. So, how do you explain? The last caller was saying if you look at cities, they tended to be more toward, the John Kerry and the urban areas, which our caller at least characterized as less well-informed, were voting for George W. Bush. I mean, is that a mythical division, or is there something real there that's obscuring something important? I don't know.
Well, the last time I looked at the electoral map, there were some cities that were red and some cities that were blue. I mean, if you want to talk about New York, Boston, San Francisco, and argue that those are the cities, then that's true. But on the other hand, the Republican vote increased throughout even those areas. I mean, the Republicans did better in New York this time than they did last time. And there are plenty of cities in the United States that are red, and there are urban areas that are blue. But, I mean, that's not the essential point. As I say, the elections tend to stress whatever differences we have. But even on the most divisive issues, Americans have an amazing degree of consensus. I mean, one of my favorite examples, Tocqueville noticed when he came here in the 1830s that Americans hold equal and opposite passions about all kinds of important subjects. So we are simultaneously the world's most religious and the world's most secular people. In foreign policy, we're at once the most interventionist and the most isolationist. And we all feel that way. We have both passions inside of us, at least in my opinion. So look at abortion, for example. There's a remarkable consensus in the American body politic on the subject of abortion, and it's internally contradictory. Most Americans believe, A, that abortion is bad, and B, that any woman who wants one should be able to have one. So I think a lot of the people who are looking for divisions don't notice that a lot of the consensus in American society is contradictory. And it's one of the things that makes America such a dynamic place, because we're constantly dealing with a lot of these things. I mean, we believe, for example, most Americans believe that people who are rich have gotten that way because they earned it. But a majority of Americans also believe that spiritual values are more important than commercial or materialistic values.
But doesn't that make it, I mean, okay, so doesn't that make it hard for somebody who's trying to characterize what it is to be an American to tear their hair out in frustration? Because, you know, it's a, on the one hand, on the other hand, where do you come down? How do you quantify such a thing?
Well, you quantify both halves of the tension. And you say Americans are and always have been people under extreme tension, and that extreme tension drives us. I mean, there's a reason why America is so creative, so busy, so productive, and so forth, and this is one of the reasons.
So it's a creative tension.
I think so. I mean, all the evidence is it's creative, sure.
So we agree in our ability to disagree on a lot of different topics.
Yeah, and we're surprisingly tolerant of people who hold other opinions, too. If you wait a couple of months and let people calm down from the election, you'll find that degree of tolerance spreading back throughout the society, I'm sure.
Okay, let's listen to what some of our callers have to say. Let's go first to Pete in Livermore, California. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're most welcome.
I'll try to be real quick. I happened to get in the car and, turn you on, and the subject caught my attention right away because Vanity Fair had sponsored a contest, which is now closed, an essay contest, on the American character, describe the American character, which I found a real challenge. And the best that I could sum it up in a sort of single statement of a characteristic that we all share is, basically, laissez-faire, I like what I like, you like what you like, stay out of my business. And I trace it back historically to the don't tread on me theme that I, as I recall, Ben Franklin first put into play in a comic, a political comic. My question, comment to the host, yourself, and the guest is, I mean, what do you really feel are the characteristics that set Americans apart from all the other peoples of the world? And I guess a question in looking at this, what I've posited as the unifying characteristic, I still see it being very divisive in the way that it plays out in politics and voting and things like that. You know, stay out of my business, but, you know, if it's guns, you stay out of my business. If it's two lesbians who want to get married, I'm going to be in your business. And maybe it's what the host just, or guest just said, is very contradictory, you know. But what do you think separates us from the rest of the world, you know?
Yeah, interesting question, Pete. So how would you address that, Michael Ledeen?
Well, I agree entirely with that. Americans are uniquely suspicious of government. We don't like government. I mean, look at the status polls. Who has high status in America? The people with high status are people like judges, doctors. People with low status are people like politicians. Politicians have always had low status in America. And Tocqueville, again, I mean, he's our national psychiatrist. Tocqueville noticed back in the early 19th century that the best people in America don't go into politics. And that's because government has always had relatively low status in this country. So we don't trust government. We don't want government meddling. On the other hand, most Americans also believe that government is obliged to do certain things for us, to provide a safety net for the weak and the poor and the disadvantaged and so forth, and to provide for the national defense and so on. So here again, there are things we want, and many of the things that we want require big government, but when we get big government, we don't like it because we're distrustful of government, especially big government. So there we are again.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you can, for comparison purposes, take another country and say, well, this is not the case in France or in Belgium or some or
sure.
Denmark.
Sure, well, take any European country.
Okay.
Europeans have opted for big government, where the government's going to run most of the things that impact their daily lives. I mean, there's very low philanthropy in Europe, for example. Why? Because the things that we fund privately here through private philanthropic organizations are funded by the government, by the state in Europe. And so people don't feel inclined to give private money to private undertakings. There are relatively fewer private undertakings. Europeans like big government because they want government to guide them from cradle to grave. They want government to do most things. There's very little debate on foreign policy in Europe because foreign policy is held to be something that belongs to the government, and simple common citizens don't feel obliged or inclined to get involved in those debates. Well, I mean, that's the opposite of here.
So
we challenge the government at every step.
So the mistake is thinking that the values of Americans are necessarily reflected only by the governments they choose.
Right. Most Americans don't believe that. Most Americans, when people say most politics is local, what they mean is that the things that matter to them are things that they want to decide for themselves. And, you know, there is this long history, I'm sure your previous guest talked about it, of spontaneous associations in America. I mean, we create private organizations to deal with our problems at an unbelievable rate. I mean, hundreds per day for the most outrageous things. I mean, I found a society devoted to studying the effects of Friday the 13th and so on, let alone things like, you know, the Red Cross and the Salvation Army and the things we all know about.
We have an email here from Nathan in Oklahoma who writes, didn't the press fail in their responsibility to cut through the divisive rhetoric and report some semblance of reality, nuanced, in this election? The debunking of campaign claims was sometimes done, but appears as sidebars, features not central to the coverage. I guess that goes back to that question of whether the government is the whole story. But did the press exacerbate this sense of division?
Well, a large part of the press has certainly become partisan on both sides and has been sorely tempted to restrict the flow of information that's bad for their point of view and to emphasize the flow of information that they like. Yes, a lot of that has been going on, and that we can say that that's unfortunate. However, I will say that I can't find any moment in American history when it was markedly better than it is now. I mean, one of the nice things about America is that we have all these self-corrective mechanisms. So if the printed press tilts strongly in one direction, you start getting bloggers and talk radio and so forth on the other side. And so there's competition, as usual. And as long as that competition is free to go on, then people will be able to pick and choose and listen and compare, and that's the important thing.
Michael Ledeen is author of the book Tocqueville on American Character and is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
We have an email here from Jenny in Redding, California, who writes, as a blue mother in a red country in a blue state, California, in the weeks before the election, my 7-year-old son rode one day in a car with a Kerry Edwards sticker, another day in a Bush Cheney car. I chose not to talk politics with this very personable family, but what remains unspoken is our common concern for our children's safety, hauling props together for Colonial Theme Day, and that sort of thing. My motivation for carpooling may be more slanted towards saving energy and hers towards saving time, but we continue to work together in our community to teach and love our children. And that takes us to my next guest. We've been talking a lot about what Americans have in common politically and culturally, but now we turn to one area of the country that remains a political and cultural battleground, the Midwest. For generations, places like Ohio have been seen as a microcosm of the country's politics and cultural diversity. To talk about how Midwesterners have found common ground despite the differences is Drew Caton, a historian of Miami, a historian at Miami of Ohio, who studies the history of the Midwest. He joins us from member station WMUB in Oxford, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be with you.
So to start off, remind us exactly why Midwestern states like Ohio have traditionally been political battlegrounds.
Well, mainly because a state like Ohio is so remarkably diverse. It doesn't get its reputation as a microcosm of the country for nothing. And you find that Ohio combines elements of the kinds of things both of your previous guests have been talking about. It was settled by both people from the Northeast, by people from the South, by Europeans. It's a place that is both urban and rural, industrial and agricultural, Protestant and Catholic. So Ohio for almost 200 years has been a very sharply divided state, and it's one of the reasons why it's played such a major role in American politics.
So, I mean, given the diversity, have folks been able to develop a common culture? It reminds me there's a Well, never mind. I was just thinking about a children's book where it says, we got this all the way from Ohio, as if that explained everything. But
Well, you know, Ohio has a reputation for being a fairly homogeneous place, a kind of heartland, midland place like much of the Midwest, in which people emphasize sort of generic American values like family and work and religion and morality and so on. And I think it goes back in part to what Tom Smith was talking about earlier, which is, and it's useful what he's saying, which is that Americans do share a lot of these values in common. But I think when you start talking specifically about what those values mean and what you talk when you talk about policy, then the kinds of underlying conflicts that Americans have, I think, come to the surface. And that's why I think elections are important. I don't think elections are just these kind of interruptions in a consensus where people have a few moments of spats with each other and then go on to something else. I think they're talking about real power and the power to implement certain kinds of cultural visions. And I think that's why they become so important. In a state like Ohio for 200 years, you've been trying to deal with mechanisms for dealing with a situation where it's very difficult for any group to get a permanent majority, where the state is so evenly divided in many ways that people have had to try and develop a culture that allows them to continue to talk to each other and get along with each other. And one of the ways you do that, I think, in Ohio, in the Midwest, and this happens everywhere in the world, but I think particularly in this part of the world, is to de-emphasize difference and emphasize consensus. I think, you know, it's a very Midwestern thing to do, to come out after an election 2 weeks later with a study in Chicago that talks about what we all have in common with each other.
We're talking with Drew Caton. He's a historian of the Midwest at Miami University in Ohio. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So, okay. So this is funny because you're talking about, you know, are they really papering over or in this case, studying over the differences? Or are there more commonalities than differences?
Well, you know, I mean, I think your previous guest, Michael Ledeen, was right. I mean, there are all these contradictions. And if you ask somebody at one time what they believe, they may believe something different 2 or 3 weeks later. But if you look at the history of Ohio, for example, you see Ohioans have divided fairly sharply over some fairly serious issues. Slavery, for example. Questions of drinking, temperance in the 19th century were as divisive, if not more divisive, actually, to the point that people went to war with each other, than the current kinds of issues that we're talking about today. But the common theme, I think, throughout the history of the state has been this effort to sort of divide, decide, and define exactly what things like family and morality mean. And so on a day-to-day basis, sure, people get along with each other, and you drive through a small town in Ohio, and you see Kerry signs and Bush Cheney signs, and these are the same people we work with, and we go to the stores with, and, you know, we see in the street, and our children are together in schools, and, you know, it's not that people are necessarily out getting angry with each other all the time, but I don't think we should rush too much to assume, therefore, that there are not really seriously different visions of what the future of the United States should be all about.
I don't want to push this, but an analogy just popped into my head, which I'll share, which is the notion that we can all be baseball fans, but that doesn't mean that people who root for the Red Sox are going to be friendly with the people who root for the Cincinnati Reds, let's say.
Well, right. Well, I mean, if you asked a group of Americans in the Midwest and said, do you think religion is important? Of course, most people are going to say yes. But when you start asking more specific questions about what role religion should play in politics, about whether or not a particular kind of religious morality should decide policy in the United States, then you get, I think, very serious, concrete fights amongst people. And I think part of what people talk about when you talk about a kind of Midwestern culture of people being nice to each other is that as much as possible people avoid discussing those issues. I heard someone on television talking about focus groups in Ohio talking about the gay marriage issue in the state, and I thought it was very revealing that one focus group said everyone in it was going to vote for the amendment against gay marriage, but nobody wanted to talk about it. Nobody wanted to explain why. And I think that's a very Midwestern kind of idea. I have my beliefs, I have my values, but I don't necessarily want to be ostentatious about it. And I think that follows not from this part of the country being, as most people think, bland and homogeneous, but quite the contrary, that it's a region of so much sharp divisions culturally and religion, class, urban versus rural, and so on, that people have developed a kind of civic culture and consumer culture that allows them to emphasize things that they have in common with each other.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Drew Caton is a historian of the Midwest at Miami University in Ohio. He joins us from member station WMUB in Oxford, Ohio. Thanks very much. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our discussion about America's common values. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. Today, we're talking about how Americans find common ground despite all the talk about a divided America. Next, to talk about how political leaders help to bridge or broaden the difference between or among Americans is Roderick Hart, a professor at the University of Texas, Austin, who studies political communication. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, we've been talking a lot about how Americans, despite our differences, can find common ground. But what about our political leaders? Do they have a stake in appealing to our differences? Is it better for them to emphasize the differences, or should they be pulling us together, or are they?
Well, I think it depends on whether they're in campaign mode or in governance mode. One of the things we know from research is that campaigns tend to focus upon differences, at least in the primary season, and then increasingly they try to find some point in the middle of the road. But I think there's always value in appealing to that which is common, particularly in the United States, because we're such a tremendously diverse nation.
Which presidents would you say have shown the best ability to use language that unites us?
Well, you know, I think in many ways all of them have to be able to do that. You do it from Jimmy Carter, who always was trying to find the kind of the moral center of the country, Ronald Reagan. His focus was oftentimes upon the common man, able to strive and earn a living. Bill Clinton, appealing to our hopes for the future. And I think those are all things that all Americans share, and I think each president has kind of taken a stab at it in their own way. The current president was talking about an ownership society. All of us want to be part of that, and so I think it's a each of them are trying their own way to find that middle ground.
Is that, I mean, you talked about the difference between campaign mode and governance mode. Is it your sense that people have been staying in campaign mode pretty much round the clock? Because it seems like the minute you win one election, you're starting to, you know, maneuver for the next, and governance seems to take a back seat, or does it? I'm
wrong. Absolutely, it does. And some of the research I've done in the past finds that just the number of speeches that a president gives now is almost the same in when he's during a campaign or not during a campaign. There's just a constant attempt to work the attitudes and opinions of the American people. So yes, I think there is something called a continual campaign, and it does sharpen differences.
Do you see anything changing in that, or are we stuck with this for the foreseeable future?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think it depends on whether or not our leaders want to allow their surrogates to do their work, or they want to do it themselves. And I think increasingly what's happened is that the parties have become much more divided from one another and much sharper in their discourse. And the president's job is to kind of transcend all of that. But I think presidents have not been doing that, especially during the Clinton and Bush administrations.
All right. We'll leave it there. Roderick Hart, thanks for joining us.
Enjoyed it.
Roderick Hart is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin who studies political communication. He joined us from his office in Austin.